Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Weekend Preview Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again, as always, by Quint Kesnick. Quint, we have gone from 16 to 8. It is the most wonderful time of the year, but I'll tell you what, the weather, man, it's got me down.
A little Seattle-like in Baltimore today, a little on the chilly-ish side. Found myself wanting a coffee here after driving through the rain and getting into the office. It's a shame for the folks who are in Baltimore to watch the Preakness on Saturday. Friday, Saturday is going to be a total washout. Sunday, though, it's looking like the sun's going to come out for Annapolis, a high of 80. So could be good conditions there. Long Island at Hofstra on Saturday, not so much. It looks like rain Saturday. Cool temperatures, though. Great for the athletes. Maybe a high of 59, 60. So poor Kark. He'll be rain-sogged down on the sideline. Greg Grenlian is actually joining us for that, that Denver-Albany game. And they can micromanage the face-off battle. But I'm just excited. We got two great games each day. Car service in between to take us from Hofstra to Annapolis, so I don't have to risk my life getting in a car with Kark. Everything's great.
And as we prepare to look forward, we start by looking in the rearview mirror. What were a few takeaways from opening weekend that have stuck with you 4 or 5 days later where you said to yourself, wow, either I was surprised to see that or not necessarily surprised, but that is very important. That is very influential. Got to make sure to keep that top of mind.
Maryland's halftime transformation from a team that was sleepwalking to a team that actually played with great energy. I asked John Tillman about that on Thursday. He said that Bryce Young spoke in the locker room, but it was calm. It was kind of business as usual. But Roman Puglisi's goal, I thought, was the changer. You know, when you get a freshman, a role player, scoring his first career goal, I thought the Terps all of a sudden had a hop in their step, and they played with great energy. You know, they have a history of not playing well in that first round, if you really go back and look at it, whether it was a close Bryant game, Quinnipiac, you know, taking that game into the second half in 2016, a 2015 game that they probably should have lost to Yale. Yale had the lead in that game. A Cornell win in 14, a Cornell loss in 13, and then go back to 2012 even, when Lehigh had him on the ropes. So Maryland historically has not played well in that first round. That doesn't faze me. What stands out for me Cornell-wise is, you know, what do you do with Jeff Teat? You know, when he's been shut off in three of the last four games, Cornell's offense has only averaged 8.3 goals. Should I keep going with these matchups?
Well, no, I think I want to make one point, which is with respect to not playing well in the first round, I am disappointed in myself for overreacting to Notre Dame's hot end of season and it seeming as if they figured out their scoring issues and, you know, the 14-goal, 17-goal, 17-goal output in successive games. I've made this argument over the course of the last couple of years that when people talk about peaking at the right time, I think that peaking last 2 weeks of the regular season is too early. Even peaking in the first round of the NCAA tournament, to me, peaking at the right time is playing your best game in the quarterfinals and carrying that momentum over the course of the next 9 days.
I agree. One thing, I think we spoke about it last week on this podcast, Terry, is overemphasizing conference tournament play and reacting, wow, Denver looked horrible against Villanova. Wow, Maryland didn't really bring it against Hopkins in the finals. You know, I think those are unique circumstances. They're all rematch games, and we tend to put too much into those championship games. It's coming back on 1 day's rest. And you also pointed out that, you know, Selection Sunday is a bit of a reset button because there's new life. When that bracket comes up, you know, the bracket doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care if you're 14-4 or 8-8. We've learned that with North Carolina a few years back. We've seen unseeded teams make it to championship weekend. So in a year that is very equal, you know, these eight teams are the best eight. I feel strongly about that. And people talk about tournament expansion. Hey, folks, there ain't nobody out there who didn't get in this tournament who fits in with these eight teams. Thank you very much. Rutgers, no offense, Bucknell, Ohio State, I'm sorry. Tournament expansion, we're playing the same eight teams here in the quarterfinals.
Couple more notes from the first round before we move on, because to your point about not overreacting to conference championships, one of the teams that I felt like you could make the argument that they were not as good as their championship performance suggests was Georgetown. despite the fact that they lost in overtime in at Homewood Field to Johns Hopkins in the seventh game of the weekend, I thought that they clearly showed they belonged, right? And what they did in the Big East Championship against Denver was not an aberration.
No, if you look at their defense over the course of the season, they went from being an unexperienced group with an excellent defensive midfield to actually playing a very tight 6-on-6 defense with a goalie as good as any. And I'll go so far as saying that if Nick Morocco played at Notre Dame, I believe Notre Dame is still playing in this tournament, okay? So Morocco's worth 2.5 to 3 goals a game. But they had a plan. I didn't think Hopkins managed the first three quarters of that game very well. I think Johns Hopkins was content to let Georgetown potentially steal that game by playing a slow tempo game on a cool day. If it was hot, yeah, I get it. Georgetown just ran out of gas. It's as simple as that. The score was 9-6, 8-3, then 9-6. Georgetown should have used their two timeouts in the fourth quarter at the 5 and 10 minute marks as water stops during a marathon. Nobody gets to mile 18 and mile 22 of a marathon and bypasses a water stop. When you're playing a lacrosse game with 8 guys and you get to those points and you got two timeouts in your pocket, shame on you, because those guys needed a breather. And I believe if they had judiciously, is that a word?
It is. Well used.
Used their timeouts, they may have won that ball game. They clearly just ran out of gas.
Two more points. Yale-UMass. Yale 15-13 victors. I have a hard time wrapping my head around this game because you can make the argument UMass was a mid-30s team on a ratings standpoint. The fact that Yale kind of clung to a 2-goal victory doesn't say a lot for a team that I've argued over the last 2 weeks is a top, maybe the best team in the country. And when you combine that with their loss to Cornell in the Ivy League championship game, you can make the argument that Yale is not playing their best lacrosse right
now. Where's their confidence right now for the Yale Bulldogs? This again, dare to be great. You know, hey, we got to dream of a championship. We got to dream of championship weekend. We have to dream of an Ivy League title. And I think too often that group has been content to just being good and not great. I will say this. In spurts, they did look like a championship team. That was my theme of the whole first round weekend was spurts. Loyola played in spurts. Let Virginia come back in the game. Same with the UMass Yale game. Yale led 14-7. It was like game over. We're out of here. Moving on. We're doing great. Next thing you know, the final was 15-3. Cornell had that poor spurt when Syracuse took the lead. Johns Hopkins second and third quarter shut down for 30 minutes. Nobody played the full 60 minutes last week. Okay, maybe Denver you could say would be the closest, but that's going to have to change. You don't win a contested quarterfinal game with an incomplete effort. I don't think anyone's that good. You're going to have to play 60 this week.
Last note from the weekend. How did you spend the 2-hour and 14-minute lightning delay when you were getting ready to broadcast that Loyola
Virginia
game?
You saw it. You went out for coffee. You were kind enough. I wasn't crazy enough to have coffee. But the problem was when I got home, I couldn't fall asleep anyway. It was long. I was kind of worn out after that game. It just seemed like a forever. I didn't time my eating well. You know, I went really light on my eating at home, being a home game, and if you eat too much, you get tired, and it impacts your vocabulary level. So I went into that game a little hungry, and then next thing you know, there's a 2-hour and 14-minute rain delay. All the Chick-fil-A in the press box is gone. There's Twizzlers and water and Diet Cokes. And have you ever tried to drink Diet Coke for 4 hours straight? It's really not a good thing. So that was a challenge. I never like rain delays. I'm just thankful that they got the game in.
No doubt, because otherwise it would have created quite the debacle.
Major deal, and mostly because there was a women's game slated for that field at noon.
Yep,
and I don't think the coaches wanted to come back at 8 or 9 a.m. and play it. TV, it was the same production crew, same TV truck that had to move to Johns Hopkins to set up for the next day. What we would have probably said is, hey, Loyola, can you move a game to Hopkins? Let's play a doubleheader. And they would have been like, no. So they probably would have ended up playing that game Sunday afternoon, 5 o'clock. And I'm guessing that Loyola may have been able to set up their cameras and shown it over the internet.
But as it was a good game that I've seen the replay a couple times now, and it looks pretty good on TV. Late at night.
Yeah, you know, it was disappointing. I was disappointing in the crowds overall. You know, the
minus Albany.
Minus Albany, the 4,800 at Albany. You know, there's a push-pull here between it being an NCAA event and being hosted on campus. At a time where finals, graduation, a lot of things going on in people's lives, with only a week to sell tickets, with an NCAA budget, quite honestly, that's non-existent in terms of radio, online, getting the word out and selling tickets.
Well, not only that, but they also focus then Loyola, on the Final Four.
Yeah, and Loyola's crowd, I think, was going to be very good. The parking lot was full. Yeah. The people were there. And then they left and watched us on TV. And I really had great expectations of a raucous, cool crowd. I thought the Dome crowd was okay, not great. The crowd at Albany was fantastic, and that's good to see. And I hope we get crowds this weekend. You know, if you live in the Baltimore area and you're listening to this podcast, it's as simple as going to the Preakness on Saturday and then waking up Sunday morning, making your Bloody Marys, and heading down to Navy Marine Corps Stadium with a tailgating. It's going to be fantastic. You're going to get to see Maryland and Johns Hopkins, okay? You're either wearing red or you're wearing blue. Cornell, you're wearing red. Duke, you're wearing blue. You're tailgating, you're having a good time. After the games, if you want, go down to Annapolis, have dinner, and drive home. It's the greatest weekend of all time. I got friends from New York who have come down now since I was in college, since the mid-1980s. And I remember, I remember classic weekends that they had back when Easy Goer and Sunday Silence dueled it out back in 1989. And I wasn't able to go to that game, that race. But I got pictures of their great times at Pimlico for the Preakness.
Are you all in on?
No, Justify's got he's got a little heel issue going on, maybe a little quarter crack, which is like a hoof thing, and they're saying it's fine. But I've got some people in the industry who are a little concerned about it. It's a similar injury to what Big Brown had prior to his unsuccessful Belmont. So it's a time bomb. It could be fine. Like, it's one of those things you can't, like when they say no hoof, no horse, no foot, no horse, like you can have this great, it was like a flat tire. I mean, it's like you could be in the greatest Maserati of all time, but if the tire pops, like, sorry, you can't go fast. So at 1-2, I'll be, again, saving my money for the Belmont and Hofburg.
And the news of the week, not a lot to get to. The biggest injury coming away from week one, I thought, was Nick Brzozowski's absence for Maryland.
Talking to John Tillman on Thursday, I think they had him out of practice. But keep Matt Neufeld and Michael Adler, on your boards at home if you're playing along. Brzozowski, Adler gave up a goal on a bad approach at that game. If you watch it closely on a drive from X. He was the go guy up from crease to up top. He took an overzealous angle. Otherwise, Maryland will be healthy. They were coming off a finals week. I expect them to play with a little more energy. Cornell is got full health. Christian Knight at times has been limping around after his mid-year injury, but he's playing great at 57%. I don't have any other injuries there. I think the Blue Jays are healthy and Duke is healthy, and everything seems like everyone's all go.
Yeah. And then the last note from the week, Siena coach John Speck will no longer be roaming the sidelines for the Saints. He had been in charge of that program for 7 years, taking over for Brian Brecht when he moved on to Rutgers.
Having spent a lot of my summers up in the Capital Region and having friends who played at Siena, having gone to football games there a couple times, their assistants, their athletic director has got to raise the price of their assistants right now. I think their first assistant makes 30 grand. Their second assistant makes 12 grand. I think it could be a decent job in that league. It's a small school. You can really own. You can do a good job recruiting Syracuse and Long Island.
And Western Mass, which is
Western Mass. And I'm even going
to
say Boston with, the Catholic background. My question to you, Terry, is what type of coach has an interest in the Siena job? Is it a young Division I assistant? Is it a longtime D3 successful coach? I mean, what tier does a job like this? And because, again, Division I jobs are not, they're in short supply.
No question.
Are you better off being a longtime assistant at a Yale or an Ivy, top Ivy team, or, a top CAA team? Anthony Gallardi, is that Siena job a step, or is that Siena job a lateral move for a guy like that?
Yeah, in those particular instances, I think that is viewed as either a lateral move or a step back. I think
even though it's your own program and you have the chance to go there and stamp it and take them to new heights.
Of course, it depends on what you value. But if job security and salary and the opportunity to be successful are your most important aspects, as opposed to freedom within your job to kind of set your trajectory for your program, then yeah, I would argue that the majority of Division I assistants, and I have to qualify that, the majority of top 20 programs Division I assistants are going to be equivalent to better than being a head coach at a bottom third program in Division I.
Interesting.
And what's interesting as well is there's a number of programs right now that fit that mold. Now, within themselves, they have a lot of diversity in terms of what they offer between, you know, Lafayette and Bellarmine and a couple of the others. Holy Cross and Siena obviously have a few more similarities because, as you mentioned, you know, the religious background and the proximity geographically. But
wouldn't you put Loyola in that mix? Is this not Loyola. Dave Cottle? Is this not Dave Cottle taking the Loyola job
at Siena
in the mid to late 80s when he took the Loyola job and he built it from what it was to what it is now? Couldn't someone do the same thing at Siena?
The answer is yes. The variable that's most important is how much are they willing to care a lot about lacrosse? And the difference between Loyola in the late, well, the difference between Siena is a basketball school. They have a big arena. They have invested a lot in their basketball program.
I believe that's a positive.
I believe it's a negative because I think that at a place like that, it sucks up one premier program sucks up resources from all the others and becomes a little bit more of an afterthought. And I think that there are some athletic departments that are a little bit better distributed across, and I think Loyola falls into that category. I actually think that Loyola has the advantage, and this is why, you know, the level of their success might be higher than an equivalent program or an equivalent university, of caring most about lacrosse out of any sport on campus.
True.
And there are very few that fall into that camp.
Interesting. Okay.
So it'll be fascinating to see. I think that
we're still waiting for some of these other schools to sort out what's going to go on with their head coach. Cornell's in an interim situation.
Exactly. Yep. And then Air Force is in a fluctuating situation. We don't know whether there's going to be an interview situation there. Bill Wilson spent the season as the head coach. There's a lot of dominoes to fall because there's a belief out there that there are some, you know, programs who haven't made the decision as to whether or not their head coach is going to come back next year. Some high profile programs as well.
Do we have firm news on Michigan and North Carolina
in terms of their assistance?
Yes.
No, I've heard of a few applicants or folks who are interviewing for that Michigan assistant job, the one that was previously held by Connor Ford, and have yet to confirm any changes in the North Carolina coaching staff.
Gotcha.
All right, Quint, let's go ahead and bring on our guests. And when we come back, we will talk about the week ahead. Trimino protein-infused water has 7 grams of whey protein and essential B vitamins to fuel your game. Ideal before, during, or after your workout, hydrate with a beverage as versatile as you are. Play hard, not hungry. Protein is an important part of any athlete's diet, and supplement yours without excess calories and fat. Go beyond hydration with Trimino protein-infused water. 7 grams of whey protein, no sugars, no carbs, no fats, only 28 calories, 100% of your daily recommended allowance of B vitamins, and it comes in 7 delicious flavors: coconut, pineapple, peach, strawberry lemonade, mixed berry, raspberry limeade, my favorite, orchard, and citrus. Protein never tasted so good. And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with ESPNU commentator Anish Shroff, who was kind enough to give me a shout-out on Saturday night after that extensive lightning delay at the Ridney Athletic Complex. Anish, how did you make it through that game that ended at, like, midnight on Saturday?
Now this is just self-promotion on your end. I could not have done it without Terry Foy's Dunkin' Donuts run. So what do I owe you? I owe you like $2 and a coffee down the road in Annapolis or Long Island.
Yeah, with a sugar packet to be named later. It was really fitting that game was being played at my alma mater because it felt reminiscent of my role in college, which was the late night beer runner. Like when we would run out, it was always your boy who was walking around to the corner store making sure that the party didn't end prematurely. So it felt very, very familiar.
Yeah, you were taking care of the press box. That was a heavy hitter lacrosse media crowd on hand. You took care of everybody. That was good on you, man. No, we appreciate it. It was a painfully long delay, but and you got lightning in the area. What can you do? We ended up getting the game on the air. I thought Quint brought up a good point. He said, you know, when things like this happen, it makes it exponentially harder for the road team, and that was the case Saturday night.
No question. Saw Virginia come out of the gate slow, and Loyola turned on the gas in the second quarter and kind of held on down the stretch to a 14-12 victory, and that parlays nicely into game one of the week, Yale versus Loyola. And I don't want to necessarily go game by game because that's what Quint and I do, but I'm curious, what about this matchup, this Loyola-Yale game, has you most excited?
Well, I think you take the obvious and then you dive a little deeper. And the obvious is you've got Ben Reeves for Yale, Pat Spencer for Loyola, two of the best offensive talents, two of the most creative offensive talents. Both have great vision, great finishing skills. We're talking about two of the most complete offensive players and two of the best offensive players in college lacrosse. And I think everybody kind of zeroes in on that matchup. But this is not like the Denver-Albany game where the two guys in the spotlight, Baptiste and Erland, actually go head-to-head. And Spencer and Reeves have challenging matchups because of the defensive personnel of the opposition. And that's what I'm most excited to see. How does Ben Reeves match up with a Foster Huggins, who's the only guy in the country averaging 3-plus caused turnovers a game? Ivy League Player of the Year, Patriot League Defensive Player of the Year. And then on the flip side, we've seen how good Chris Fake has been this season. Ivy League Rookie of the Year, first-team All-Conference, only freshman on the first-team All-American squad. How will Fake do against Pat Spencer? I think that's the game within the game. Everybody's going to focus on Reeves versus Spencer, Reeves v. Spencer. They don't actually go head-to-head. They're going head-to-head with two really good defensemen, two elite defensemen. That, to me, is the game within the game, and I think that whoever wins that matchup or whoever doesn't lose the matchup worse than the other guy, I think that's going to be what determines the outcome of this game. I think it's Huggins and Fake will have a lot more to say about the outcome than Spencer and Reeves.
You know, I set that question up pointedly, and now I want to ask one more broadly, which is, which game is most exciting to you heading into the weekend?
This is going to sound like such a cop-out. I'm doing all of them, so you're going to be like, well, I don't believe you if you say all of them. But I tweeted this out after all the games were done in the first round. I'm looking at the eight teams that have made it this far to the quarterfinals. Any of these eight teams have the potential to be the last team standing. When I saw the original bracket came out, I had nine teams that I thought could win the championship. Of those nine, eight are still playing. The only team that lost, the one that I, of course, picked to win it all, Notre Dame. But the eight teams left are all capable of winning a championship. And so every game in this quarterfinal round has a juicy subplot, whether it's the face-off matchup with Albany and Notre Dame, whether it's Connor Kelly against Jeff T, Reeves against Spencer, Danowski and Dino being only, Danowski and Petromala being, two of four active coaches with multiple championships in the history from last year with Hopkins and Duke. There's a juicy subplot in all these games, so I know it's a cop-out here, but Terry, I'm going to go with C, all of the above.
Okay. All right. I'll let you off the hook on that one. But sticking along the theme of looking at the weekend as a whole, what lessons have you kind of learned over the course of your tenure covering the quarterfinals that you think or you expect are going to rear their head this weekend in terms of the style of play or the mental approach or the stakes and pressure in history? Is there anything that you're carrying into this weekend that you've learned from just being around the quarterfinals for a number of years?
Yeah, this is the hardest game of the tournament, without question. This is the game where the pressure is on because if you get to championship weekend, you're remembered forever. They don't do 20-year reunions for teams that make it to the quarterfinals. You get to championship weekend, those teams are bonded and those teams stay together forever. Fans remember those teams. There's almost this stamp of approval. It's the same as in college basketball. Elite Eight teams, that's a great run. People remember Final Four teams. They kind of become bookmarks in a program's history. And, there's three teams in the field right now. I look at Yale, not having been there since 1990, significant pressure on the Elis. Can they get to championship week? I look at in Albany, a team that's never been to championship weekend and a team that's had its heart broken in the quarters in three of the last 4 years, significant pressure on Albany. And then the last one is Duke. Look at this senior class. They came to Durham on the heels of eight straight trips to championship weekend. Justin Gutterding and his fellow seniors have not been to the semifinals. This is their last hurrah, their last chance to get there. to try to, you know, bring back that legacy. They haven't been there, and I think there's significant pressure on Duke. So I think those three teams carry the most weight, biggest burden, because to me, this is the hardest game in the tournament to win, because, you know, if you win in the quarterfinals, there is a sense of accomplishment regardless of what happens from here on out.
Coaches are masters of spin, and it can be difficult to fully trust the things they say heading into a game. You've had an opportunity to talk to most, if not all, of these coaches as you prepare for the weekend. From a tone standpoint, was there anything that you heard that gives you a little bit more confidence that his team is going to be ready on Saturday or Sunday?
Well, we've talked to the four coaches in the Annapolis portion of the bracket, because we'll meet with the coaches in person tomorrow on the Hofstra side of things. You know, without divulging too much, because a lot of those conversations are sort of in confidence and for on-air use only, but not surprising, really. I think the two guys, I think by far and away, the most calm, and you could probably guess here, was Dinowski. You know, he came in listening to his classic rock, very relaxed, very kind of matter-of-fact. That conversation took its usual tangents, and, you know, we spent probably 15, 20 minutes talking about the World Lacrosse Championships in Israel, but very relaxed, very calm, and you get a sense, you know, from a guy who knows what it takes to win this game and who did it 8 years in a row and who's got three national championships. And then I thought the other one who, you know, I got a good vibe from was Petromal. Not to say I didn't get a good vibe from Millman or Tillman, but again, there was, I think, a little bit of relief on the side of Johns Hopkins after what happened last week, coming back against Georgetown, finally putting, you know, the first round memories of the previous 2 years behind them. And I think they're hungry and ready for another chance at Duke. You look at the last three NCAA tournament meetings with Hopkins and Duke. Duke's won all three of those, and it hasn't been close in any of them, especially last year.
Well, Anish, as we prepare, I'm going to be on site, so unfortunately I'm not going to be able to get treated to all of your mythological and literary or pop culture references, but can we get a sneak peek for anything that might be in the chamber for use over the weekend for our listeners who are going to be tuning in on ESPNU?
Oh, you think I pre-planned this stuff, huh?
No, more so, is there anything that you've been watching or reading recently that's just kind of worked its way into your subconscious that you think you're not going to be able to help but incorporate into the broadcast?
I don't know yet. You know, that's kind of usually my homework for the night before. You know, I'll start making some notes. I have probably, I don't know, 10 or 15 notebooks from over the years that I just fill up when I hear something or I read something, a word, a phrase, whatever it might be, and I just kind of scribble it down. And what I usually do is I'll carry one of those with me for the course of a season, whether it's lacrosse, football, basketball. I'll just kind of mix it up. And I'll just kind of leaf through it, usually before the game. You know, just, and that kind of just puts it in the, you know, in the neural net processor. And then if I see something, something kind of pops up. But I don't know. Awesome goodies. You put me on the spot. You know, it's only Thursday. I got two more days. So, I'll have something for sure. We'll see
no
what
doubt.
That is.
Well, the problem is that I probably wouldn't have understood anyway, because I'm not in the Infinity Wars ecosystem. You know, haven't watched Evil Genius
yet. Neither am I.
Yet.
I'm not. I haven't. I got a 7-month-old, man. I can't tell you the last time I've gone to a movie theater.
I'm right there with you. It's like going on 3 years for me. So, Anish, to that end, we know you got to run. We really appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. We look forward to the broadcast starting noon Saturday, ESPNU, Yale, Loyola, and then the subsequent three games over the course of the weekend. You got a hefty workload, but I know how much you and your squad are ready for it and look forward to relishing the moment.
Thanks for the Duncan.
And the Inside Lacrosse podcast continues with Greg Grenlian, former MLL faceoff specialist, Team USA member, guest sideline analyst for ESPNU this weekend, and co-founder of the Faceoff Academy. Greg, thank you so much for joining us. We know that you're grinding away with some savages in a little bit, so we're just going to dive right into the matchups. Obviously, Trevor Baptiste taking on TD Erlin. 2:30 ESPNU from Hofstra quarterfinals. It's a hotly anticipated matchup. What's your take? Where do you think this is going to fall out?
I think it's awesome. It's great for the sport. It's really cool for the position. people forget, like, I was talking to Lax Film Room yesterday, and we were saying no one has mentioned Albany's offense, Nanticoke. They haven't, like, no one's talking about anybody. They're talking about the faceoff guys. That's insane for the sport. So I think it's going to be pretty awesome. Getting to see it in person will be cool. I think that the universe owes us this, since we never got to see the Ben Williams Trevor Baptiste matchup that we all wanted to see last year. So this is going to be awesome. I think both of these guys have to do what they do best and limit their mistakes. And it'll be interesting to see which guy takes a chance on altering what he usually does in order to try to gain an advantage and takes a chance on that.
Do you know whether they've ever faced off against one another in non-game settings or competition? Is there any familiarity?
No. I don't think they've even gone against each other at, like, a Placid situation. Yeah. TD's upstate.
Yep.
Trevor Jersey. So, like, it's just been, it hasn't happened yet.
It's really exciting. And one of the things that I'm interested in your perspective on, you know, given your style, given your familiarity with so many successful face-off specialists, is if you're a newcomer to the sport, you probably look at these two standing next to each other and assume that Trevor's going to out-physical or out-muscle TD, and TD's going to have to out-quick Trevor. But my understanding is that that's actually probably a little bit counterintuitive, and that it might be the inverse, that each guy relies on a little bit more. How do you shake that out?
Yeah, I think the misconception for people, you hear people, there's two terms I hear all the time as a face-off guy that kind of drive me crazy. Someone will be like, oh, you know, he's going to muscle him off the ball. You literally can't do that. You're not allowed to push the person. You're not allowed to batter him with your helmet. And then some people say, oh, they're going to try and muck it up so that the guy can't win clean. Like, that's not a thing. When you talk about the strength or weight advantage, it can be an advantage if you use it towards your right hand. So the reason Trevor's very dominant is that there is power behind what he does. And power needs both strength and speed. So his right hand, and I call it a hammer blow, he literally, our goal as faceoff guys is to make our right hand super heavy. And the way he does it is it ends up tilting his helmet directly over the ball as he pushes it with his right hand. And you can draw a line straight from his face mask down towards the ball that's perpendicular to the ground. That's called dominating the column. That's how he owns people. TD has the exact same speed as Trevor on the whistle. The only thing that TD gives up is sometimes he steps back with his left foot and loses that column. That's what happened against Mackey. TD learned from that, and you can tell he's putting more weight into his left foot when he pushes. If he eliminates that issue, we're going to have a war on our hands. If he steps back on the whistle, then he's going to have a really tough day.
Is there anything about the way that this is going to be officiated that will have a significant and potentially undue outcome?
You know what? I commend you, because that's the first time someone's brought that up. And yes, we have noticed, like, everyone talked for like 3 weeks about the 45-second face-off with Travisano that Trevor had. That was directly correlated to the fact that the ball was placed, the heads were not aligned correctly. The heads were square. We should have a top-to-stop lineup where the top of the head lines up to the ball stop of the opponent. So if the heads are not square, it's a lot harder to get into a lockup. Now, Trevor uses a Nike CEO. He drive the 90% of that head is useless. You drive the throat right into the ball, and it bends back. It peels like a banana. TD will be using an STX Dual, which folds on an oblique. So if TD can get his bottom sidewall to come underneath the ball, he'll have the ability to get to his feet and rip the ball out. And that is the CEO's weakness. So it'll be very interesting. If the referees put the ball and line the sticks up the way they're supposed to, it'll give TD an advantage.
Interesting. Okay. Continuing to open up the aperture a little bit, 2 weeks ago I had Trevor on, talked about the adjustment to life without Sean Mayle, and he pointed out that they've been running a lot of two short stick wings. Just in general, can you describe both teams' approach as a unit, and how TD will try to interact with his wings relative to how Trevor will try to interact with his.
Yeah, that's actually part of the TLN breakdown that we have today, dropping on Instagram and Twitter. It's all about wing play, and something that never gets talked about is post-whistle wing play. People talk a lot about where you line your wings up. Trevor is way more advanced as far as wing pops and using his wings to displace the ball early on the whistle than TD is. TD is a self-pop guy. Doesn't use his wings that much. And I think if he did early, tried to get the ball to his wings, it would throw Denver's entire game plan off. Now, on the other side of things, after the whistle, Denver has to fix what they did last week against Notre Dame. Last week, Trevor won almost every clamp. However, Trevor's own wings, is specifically his left side or his draw side wing, would run in like 2 yards away and try to box out. But that doesn't help anyone. That brings six guys into a five-yard square circle. If you can instead take your shorty and have him stop 8 to 10 yards behind Trevor, his opposing wing player would then have to decide, do I stop Trevor from exiting or do I stop the wing from getting the ball? And that creates 10 yards of space for Trevor. Trevor's very good at finding his wings. So if Denver can space themselves out on the wing after the whistle rather than gravitating towards Trevor, it would actually help him a ton.
Fascinating. And then the last question about this matchup specifically is, what do you think the likelihood that, well, I'm going to ask this question in two parts. The likelihood that one guy gets a significant advantage over the other, and then secondly, the likelihood that any face-off, much less many face-offs, turn into early offense for the unit or the specialist who comes away with the ball, the athlete who comes away with the ball.
Yeah, so I don't think either guy is going to be smoking the other for fast break goals, because if, like, at least at, with how much is on the line for this game, I would expect for two guys of this level to both have their short sticks deep on the defensive side to stop a fast break. Both guys have the capability to change a game on its ear, and both teams are going to feed directly off of their faceoff guys' ability to win faceoffs. It's going to fuel the whole stadium. So you don't want to be the guy who gives up a fast break goal. So right off the bat, that's not going to be – I don't think that'll be something we see where a faceoff guy comes straight down and scores unless someone totally screws up. Now, on the other side of it, I don't think one guy is going to completely house the other in either matchup. But what I will say is I know Trevor as a person far longer than I know TD. And in my interactions with TD – He's a great guy. He's very, very capable of being the catalyst in this moment. However, TD hasn't been in as many games as Trevor at this level as far as how much is at stake. And I feel like for TD, if he loses three or four in a row to start the game off, I could see it being a serious mental issue for him, as opposed to I've been around Trevor when he loses a couple in a row and you wouldn't even be able to tell. He's completely even keel. So I feel like if one guy was going to go down but be able to right the ship late, it would be Trevor. But I think TD learned so much from that Yale game that we don't know. He could have grown so much that it won't affect him at all. So that's the thing. We don't know. That's why it's so cool.
You mentioned Yale, and I wanted to ask specifically about that matchup because Loyola's approach to the faceoff has been interesting. First of all, they were pretty bad to start the year, if not very bad. They have gotten incrementally better and started utilizing Bailey Savio in addition to Mike Orofice. And now they're winning at about a 40% rate, which is what we saw against Virginia. However, they have the additional wrinkle of the fact that Orofice, I think, has 9 goals on the season, and he had 2 against Virginia, prompting me to have this conversation you evoked Lax Film Room with Patrick McEwen, which was, you know, what is the value of winning or of scoring off of a one faceoff, and how important is it? Without diving into the weeds on that, just in terms of Connor Mackey versus Loyola's two-man group and how it shakes out, I mean, any heavy expectation in that one?
Connor's one of the most well-rounded face-off guys in the country, and I think if unfortunately for Connor, if it wasn't for Trevor, I think we would be talking a lot more about him. He deserves that. He's an elite-level face-off guy. He's probably second best in the country at getting his helmet over the ball and dominating leverage. So I feel like Connor's going to win the majority of the clamps. the reason Loyola has come along is, you know, obviously there's something to be said for experience. So Bailey has come along very well. But also I think him and Mike Orefici have kind of started to understand the rhythm of what their roles are at the faceoff. Rather than it being just two faceoff guys where you want to get your reps, so you secretly kind of hope that the starter doesn't win some, I think instead they've really embraced each other and helped each other in practice, and they kind of fill each other's weaknesses. So that'll be interesting, because what Orefici brings to the role, when you're watching film, you're sitting there going, if I lose a faceoff to this guy, there's a really good chance they're going to score a goal. And that really kind of creeps into your mind as a faceoff guy. So Mike has a quick rake. He's also can test ground balls. He kind of reminds me a lot of Bones Kelly when he faced off in college, where it didn't matter if Bones won the clamp or not. He could still win the faceoff, and that's how Orefici is. The only difference is Orefici will then turn around and just swim move someone and dust you to the net.
He is so fast.
He is. And the kids are relentless. I mean, it's no surprise to me, because the kid relentlessly trains all offseason. So, you know, he's got that ability that can creep into your head. So you're the fourth quarter and you're sitting there like, we're up by one or two goals. You can't relax, because if you just try to tie him up, he might find a way to screw your exit up and then just take it to the rack real quick. So it'll be interesting.
And then the last one specifically that I wanted to talk to you about, now that we've got Saturday at Hofstra in the books, I was super impressed and interested by a video that the Duke Athletics communications staff did, I believe last week, that focused on the three-man unit, and particularly the role that senior Tom Polisi, who hasn't taken a ton of draws, plays in this group, particularly a group that in Brian Smith and Joe Stein, another unit that has gotten better after not being what they were at the beginning of the season, what they are now.
Yeah, and that's like a key. I tell people all the time, like, just because somebody doesn't lead the country in something or isn't a perennial All-American doesn't mean that they don't have insight that can be very valuable, right? If that was the case, then every NBA coach would have been a Michael Jordan or a Magic Johnson, but they're not. They're usually like these short little white guys that know everything about basketball, right? So, like, the same thing here is, like, when you look at lacrosse in general, Polisi's done a great job of taking these guys under the wing. And also, Polisi's a very good stand-up neutral grip face-off guy. So that gives you something, a wrinkle that you don't really see very often. But the reason that Duke is so interesting is they're very similar to Loyola in that you got two guys. One is a freshman who have been kind of getting into their roles and taking advantage of the fact that you have two guys who are kind of selfless working under somebody else. So, he's obviously, you have to commend him for what he's done with those guys. And Brian Smith is still learning the position. Brian Smith was an All-American offensive midfielder who has now been asked to be a ACC, face-off guy. So it's very interesting.
No doubt. Anything else from the three teams that we didn't touch on that stands out, whether it be Cornell, Maryland, or Johns Hopkins?
I think these are all awesome games, and it's a shame they're not getting the attention that they should, because they're all also very good face-off matchups as well. I think that Hopkins has, Hunter Moreland, who's been a savvy vet for years, and then you got Kyle Prouty, who's going to be the next man up eventually, and I think he's going to be a stalwart for them for years. He came up huge for them down the stretch for GT in the GT game. So, yeah, I mean, these are going to be four phenomenal games, and I'm going to be at one, but I'm going to be keeping a close eye on the other three as well.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing your insight throughout the broadcast, and we thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.
Sideline Swap is where lacrosse players buy and sell their gear. Shop heads, helmets, shafts, and gloves up to 70% off, or snag hard-to-find college gear. All purchases are backed by Sideline Swap's buyer guarantee. Head to sidelineswap.com or download the iPhone app today. It is selling season on Sideline Swap. Those graduated seniors who have way more gear than they could ever use pick what they want to save for the rest of their life, and a lot of them put the rest of it up on Sideline Swap. I saw one player who just finished his college career last Sunday posted a unbelievable amount of gear. The asking price amounted to $4,200 for
really?
About like 26 different items.
Wow, all free when he was in school.
Exactly right. Who says college athletes don't get paid?
Pay for a nice summer trip to Australia or Europe.
There you go. All right, Quint, we've got four games ahead. We'll go in chronological order. We start on the Hempstead Turnpike, noon, ESPNU. The Yale Bulldogs come in as the number 3 seed to take on the number 6 seeded Loyola Greyhounds. To me, and I'm writing an article about this for InsideLacrosse.com, it's got to be a little bit like looking in a mirror. Both teams have top eight offenses and defenses. Yale is number 17 in pace. Loyola is number 24. So I think you're going to see a game where neither team's going to be afraid to run, but neither team's going to try to establish an up-tempo game. And I think at each end of the field, you have a first-team All-American attackman being guarded by a first-team All-American defenseman.
Chris Fakes, a first-team All-American?
He is, according to the Inside Lacrosse Media rankings.
Okay. Where do you want me to start, Terry? First of all, Loyola has 24 pace. That's interesting because they score more goals
in transition
from non-offensive personnel than really anyone that I've encountered this year. They got 25 goals and 12 assists from guys like Orfiche, Begley, McNulty, who I like a lot. That kid McNulty is going to be a star. Mintzloff, Savio, Higgins, even Stover. And against this 10-man, I'll take Stover at 80-1 to score a goal in this game. In the Monmouth new sports betting casino. Now, Loyola comes into this game. I think they've won eight in a row now. They shoot a high percentage, 36%. The key for them is going to be clearing against a 10-man. You know, Yale's 10-man, this 3-4-3 10-man, is really tricky, especially when you throw the ball to your defender and he goes wide. The whole Yale middle tier in that 10-man shifts ball side, and the windows are small. It's an impossible cross-field pass to make to the open guy to the far side of the field. So you got to clear that with the goalie, who then can attack the windows. It's a tricky deal. You mentioned Foster Huggins draws the assignments of Ben Reeves. Reeves and Pat Spencer are very different players. We're gonna run a comparison. You know, Reeves is such a straight line speed dodger. He's so fast. I love that kid, and he's got great outside range on his shot. Spencer, more two-handed. More COD, that is change of direction, more creative pass first, I would say. But he's got 25 unassisted goals this season. So that'll be interesting. Cause turnovers for Loyola, this big stat for them. Number two in the country in cause turnovers. Great trail checks, and they stay on their double teams. So how does Yale deal with their double teams? You mentioned the individual matchups. Yale's got good depth of scoring. So, like, if it's not Reeves, one day it was Gaudette. Last weekend it was Jackson Morrow. I like that. I think there's comfort in that. But there's kind of a newness in this territory. You know, how's their confidence level after losing to Cornell in the Ivy League championship? They're physical. Yale is. They're going to try to bang Loyola, use their size, use their athleticism. I would do the same.
That's interesting because to me, that physicality is a storyline. One of the reasons, and this is a stupid reason, but I see a lot of Loyola's 2012 defense in Yale's physicality. And I've made this comment a few times, so I apologize if you've heard it before. But the way in which Loyola, at the end of their semifinal win over Notre Dame and the end of their championship game win over Maryland, just had this stranglehold on their opposing Dodgers' ability to get any space. And there had been a couple of guys knocked out due to injury in both games. It was just unlike anything I had seen up close. And now, I don't think Yale has achieved to that level, but that was similar to the type of effort I saw out of both Harvard and Penn in the games, and even Albany to a lesser degree, in that late April stretch that really impressed me about Yale. And because this Loyola team doesn't have the same size, I do wonder how much they can overcome and how, like, is this going to be a heavyweight fight where body blows and other types of actual hits make the fourth quarter unfold a certain
way? And the size of the Fogos here jumps out at me. I mean, Connor Mackey's had a great season. I think he's, what, 64%. He's taken – he will eclipse the 400 mark in faceoffs this year. He's at 387 right now. And he's got wings at keeping him clean. And if he gets his hip on you, if he gets his hip on Savio, he's so physical. You know, he beat T.D. Erland of Albany pretty good. He beat 13-8. So I like 10. If Orfiche can make it a race, they'll look out because that kid
he is so fast.
That kid's really fast. He's fresh and he's fast and he runs a straight line. So I think the physicality of it starts on faceoffs, and that should be a lot of fun. If Loyola can tie up Mackey, if he doesn't get out quick to the whistle, look out because he's an ox.
I don't have anything else to say about this game. And
goaltending comparison could be interesting. You know, Jack Starr, the freshman, versus Stover, who's not outstanding at 52% by any means, but he's been in a lot of big games. He played in the Final Four poorly, but he played in one of those. He's won this game before. Starr coming off a bunch of subpar performances in consecutive weeks.
You mentioned faceoffs. We just talked a healthy amount about the faceoffs in Loyola versus Yale. We're going to talk a substantial more amount about that, I think, with respect to Albany coming in as the number two seed, taking on unseeded Denver, 2:30 ESPNU, immediately following that Loyola-Yale game. What do you think of this matchup? Is it overhyped, or is it as important as to the outcome of the game as everybody wants to make it seem?
I think it's a little overhyped, quite honestly. As a lacrosse player, I would rather talk about the lacrosse players who are playing here. It's a fascinating matchup between two of the current best, and Baptiste, obviously, the historical best at his position. I think that his size advantage, his technique advantage, his speed, I would be surprised if he doesn't win 16 out of 21. If Connor Mackey could beat TD 13 out of 21, isn't Baptiste going to do better? So in my eyes, Albany will have to win this game with a possession disparity, with a lot of possession time on defense, because Denver is slow-paced. Okay, what do your numbers have on Denver in terms of pace?
They are number 66.
Number 66 on pace, okay? They're going to make Albany so uncomfortable. Long possessions, people begging for the shot clock. They've played a good brand of defense lately. It's a little hard to gauge. Everyone's like, oh, Denver's defense is the best. I'm like, whoa. Possession advantage, playing in a league that's offensively challenged, okay? No offense to the Big East, but Georgetown, Providence, St. John's, and Marquette are not good offensive teams. Take a look at the numbers. The only good offensive team in that league was Villanova. Okay, so their numbers are great. They've only allowed three teams to get double digits on them this year. Towson and Duke being two of those. I think someone else, Georgetown, may have gotten a double digits on them earlier.
The first game was a 6-5 game.
Yeah,
so.
No, it wasn't Georgetown. It was someone else. But they've given up double digits three times. Denver's only beaten four teams with a winning record. Okay, they played really well last week. Terry, at the end of the day, I think they win the possession advantage. And here's my question to you. Structure and discipline versus organized chaos. Who wins?
It's so hard to pick against structure and discipline when structure and discipline has won six national championships.
I know. And structure and discipline could have the possession advantage. You know, that's why Denver's favored in this game by a goal. I see it.
Not everywhere. I looked at a line yesterday that had Albany favored by 2.5, and I'm like, pound Denver every day.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I don't like Albany. I just think that this is going to be a very difficult game for them emotionally. Okay, when you're so used to winning 80% of your faceoffs, and all of a sudden that drops down to 35%, how do you react? When your defense is used to giving up a goal here and there because we know we're going to get the ball back, you don't get the ball back. You can't give up goals here and there in this game. When Denver throws the ball around the outside for a minute and a half, and the refs aren't giving them a shot clock, how are you going to react if you're Scott Moore and the defense? And then you bring the ball down, and you're Albany, and you're zinging it, and you're not in your rhythm yet, and you throw the ball out of bounds. In some other games, you get it back. No big deal. In this game, you might not see it for another 2 minutes. So there's a lot of that going on here.
To fill in a couple of the gaps on the points that you were making, Notre Dame was the third team that got to double digits on Denver, that 11-9 regular season victory. Denver's defense is rated number 20. Albany's defense is rated number 14. There was a point at which they were top five, which suggests that they have not played as well as of late, and that matches what I have seen. 9 goals to Richmond, you know, in an 18-9 win, you'd like to see a little bit more control in that from a defensive standpoint, given the Spider personnel. You know, I think J.D. Colarusso matches that. He was a first-team All-American, according to our media voting, and the numbers bear that out, but he hasn't played as well of late. And if we're talking about getting stops, he's going to have to make saves. I think that he's going to have to get to 10, 11, or 12 saves in order to overcome the possession of disadvantage that you're talking about. And then the question becomes, it's not only about structure versus fluidity. It's also about comfort versus tension. This team, half the team, has lost in the quarterfinal. Does that come back? Does that memory resurface? You know, a quarter of the team lost a quarterfinal matchup on this field.
There's a lot of history, you know, and I like the way Albany has played this year. You know, Jacob Patterson has really been their most improved player. He's a future star. You know,
to me, he's the linchpin to allow their offense to regain some of the dimensionality and attacking nature that they had before Connor Fields' injury. And I think, I mean, I was incredibly impressed by what Fields was able to do without utilizing the majority of the arrows in his quiver against Richmond. I do wonder how indicative that is of what he'll be capable of doing against this Denver defense.
Yeah, and, you know, Nanacoke's going to probably draw Gaines or even Dylan Johnson. It's a big defense. It's a strong defense. Yeah. So, like, his size advantage is not going to be as pronounced as some other games.
A lot of teams have one big defender, and it's you can bank on that guy covering Nanacoke. That's not necessarily the case for Denver.
Correct, because they Albany's strength is they have multiple Dodgers on offense. Denver's strength on defense is, while Gaines is very good, they got some other guys who are pretty darn good cover guys too. You know, McClancy I think is a key. You know, again, what are your expectations for Connor Fields? 2-5 against Richmond. I thought he looked pretty darn good, quite honestly. But McClancy, and then getting something from the Bergmaster brothers. You know, Alex the freshman is going to be a really good player, and Jack's a leader of that team. So can you get something there? Defensively, you know, Cluck and Ray as their poles need to be playmakers in this game, because if they can convert stops, if they make stops on defense and can run while Denver's subbing out, Denver's not a get-back-in-the-hole type team. This is an offense, get off the field, bring out the defense. You know, if they can pick those moments, those gray areas, and effectively convert, as Troy Ray did three times in the first round against Richmond. And Clark's a good athlete, so it'll be interesting. But I think long possessions for Denver could be an issue for J.D. Calaruso on that defense.
Anything more on Saturday?
What's the other game?
There is no.
Oh, we talked about it already. Yeah, Coliseum Deli. You know, our ops person said, hey, does anyone have any food allergies or anything in terms of ordering? I was just like, no. All you need to know is Coliseum Deli. And she's like, well, I already got a spot fixed plate for everybody. I'm like, no, all you need to know is Coliseum Deli. So I'm excited to get some bagels on Friday morning before practices. I really am.
Are you going to hit Chicken Roost on Sunday?
Never heard of it.
The Annapolis Institution is not good enough to rise to Quint's level. Sunday, May 20th, noon, ESPNU, the Cornell Big Red reignite their rivalry against Maryland. In 2013, I wrote extensively about the depth of this rivalry, and it kind of includes or starts with...
You did?
Yeah.
1971?
John Tillman, being a Cornell alum...
spoke to him about that this morning.
What did he have to say?
Said he got his sense of humor from Richie Moran.
All right. I think a lot of people did. A lot of people got their sense of humor from Richie Moran.
Now, John Tillman played goalie, long pole, and normal midfield in his career at Cornell. They kicked him around quite a bit, and that's been a beneficial aspect of his coaching experience. He played close defense for the Baltimore Thunder. He's actually my line mate quite a bit.
Was he funny?
Tillman's always been funny, yeah. Well, he was a lot funnier then than he is now. No, but this Cornell-Maryland rivalry, you know, this is 1971, first Division I championship at Hofstra, played in front of 5,000 people. 1976 is one of the better championship games of all time. I don't remember it. I've seen clips on Wild World of Sports. ABC's Wild World of Sports was there. It was the first national televised lacrosse game. Frank Gifford was one of the hosts in his yellow jacket, which I may...
Was Jim McKay involved?
I may wear the yellow jacket to commemorate.
Some homage.
Yeah, I that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to wear the yellow jacket to commemorate. 16-13 in overtime. Okay, that was a year after Maryland had won their first title in 75. So it was a great 1970s rivalry. The modern rivalry is just quite as good. I mean, when Rob Pinnell went down there and dusted the Terps in the first round. So, you know, there's good history between these two programs.
For this outing, this chapter in the history, Patrick McEwen wrote for InsideLacrosse.com on Thursday an extensive examination of Yale's tactic or approach to Jeff Teat after there had been extensive evidence of the efficacy of shutting him off by Brown and Princeton. And then it was very difficult for me to come to a firm opinion as to whether Syracuse's defensive approach was the proper one, because I thought Pete Milliman's point postgame that Cornell benefited as much from taking Nick Mellon out of the game as
One of the most bizarre things I've ever heard.
You don't agree with that?
Your guy's averaging 6 points. How many did he get?
He caused 3 turnovers in the first half. He had 2, and he had 2 assists, right?
I thought Mellon was outstanding.
That's what I'm saying.
How many points did Jeff Teague get?
2 assists.
Right, okay.
So my
and for Milliman to call that a win for Cornell is mind-bogglingly bizarre. The guy averages 6 points. So that's a +4 for Nick Mellon in Syracuse. And to say that their 5-on-5 offense was so great, look at the numbers. They won that game because of special situations. Their man down was great. Their man up was outstanding. They generated some turnovers. Syracuse was careless with the ball, and that's why the Cuse lost. Cuse only scored 2 goals in the second half. How many playoff games are you going to win when you score 2 goals in the second half?
Not to mention the fact that they also gave
Syracuse's
up
defensive strategy was outstanding, and again, Cornell did not have answers for the shutoff. Flat out, that's how I feel, and I'm really eager to see what Maryland has up their sleeve with a week to prepare. I'll give Yale the mulligan because they only had 1 day to prepare.
I think you can make the argument that Pedersen is not as effective without the extra space allowed by the playing 5-on-5. I agree that Syracuse made some mistakes, including I think the foul, the unsportsmanlike conduct that set up the Big Reds extra man that gave them the go-ahead goal was one of the more significant plays in determining the outcome of the game. But I also think that if you're Syracuse, you have to live with the fact that you had 3 quality looks to tie the game in the last 33 seconds, and you just didn't can any of them. I thought Bomberry's open shot that
big
went
one.
Just high was the best of the 3 opportunities.
I agree.
That game really actually reminded me, I haven't said this anywhere, so I'll share it here. It really reminded me of the end of the Army-Navy game, where if you're Army, you're just like, well, that was our chance, and we had every opportunity to make it happen, and it was a very meaningful game for their prospects within the Patriot League. But all right, so circling back around to Cornell and what you would choose to do if you were Maryland, one of the points that's important is not all shutoffs are created equal. The quality of the athlete doing the shutting off is a big aspect of how effective the shutoff is going to be. Who would you task with that if you were Maryland? If you were Maryland's defensive coordinator,
I would put Curtis Corley on him.
Okay. Because of
Bryce Young's leadership, his understanding of defensive packages is more advanced of Corley. And Bryce can be an organizer when he's off the ball. I mean, at the end of the day, you want Cornell. Cornell's a great passing team. They lead the country in assists per game, 9.6. Okay, I have not seen McCulloch, Dowiak, Fletcher, Donville, Lichardi score any unassisted goals recently. Telesco scored one against Cuse, but in the 5-on-5, with all that space, a guy like Connor Fletcher has got to have an impact. I think he's a really good player. He's 6'3", 225. He's only a sophomore. He's got no ceiling. Like, I'm talking world team caliber talent, I believe he has. Right now, he just doesn't have that confidence to dodge to the dirt, to dodge to the middle. He's dodging too much to the pylons. But I make Cornell score unassisted goals to beat me.
And then
shut off Teat, make him score on assisted goals.
How does that jive with what has been Maryland's biggest flaw defensively, their invert defense, and the way in which they were exposed by Robert Morris?
Cornell does not have great invert personnel.
Okay.
They'll bring in John Piatelli, freshman from Massachusetts. They may bring in Zach Ward, a junior from Lancaster, PA, former attackman. He's an invert guy, number 30, doesn't play much. But when you look at this personnel at their midfield, these aren't invert guys. Telesco's a downhill guy. Fletcher's a downhill guy. 23, you know, he's a shooter off of cuts and off of step downs. Donville's a smart freshman, but he can play behind the goal a little. He can attack you at all angles a little more. But this is not a superb invert team.
At the other end of the field, Connor Kelly was instrumental in Maryland's comeback. Anthony DeMeo had 3 assists for his kind of breakout performance to this point in the season. Thought that was a function of, you know, a little bit of a kind of a step back for Logan Wisnoskis, who had a
struggling
couple of really good games. Not immediately failing this, but like in the middle of the season.
Freshman wall, especially during finals. Connor Kelly, good to see him. He shot 4 of 5 going into that game. He was in a 3-game shooting slump. Big time. He's now 9 for his last 36, which is 25%, which is kind of low. But he got banged up. Hopkins really took it to Kelly. They took some shots at it. And then Bernhardt not shooting well lately either. He's only 6 for his last 30. He can get around guys. There's no question. He's just got to learn how to finish. I think Maryland's advantage in this game is with midfield, midfield Dodgers. You know, Bubba Fairman is coming on, 6'1", 195. Tim Rotance, 6'1", 210. Going against three shorties who have been playing very well for Cornell. Ryan Bray, Jack Bolin, Harrison Bardwell. But they're a little bit undersized, okay? Again, this is Big Ten ACC caliber team going against the Ivy. And I think Maryland's physicality at the midfield will cause Cornell to slide.
Anything more on this one?
Interesting goalie battle. I think you get two of the better veteran goalies. Dan Morris has done everything. He's won a national championship.
By the way, I don't think Maryland beats Robert Morris without an exceptional performance from Dan Morris.
He's always pretty good. I mean, he's got two bad games in the last 2 years, the one at Ohio State and this year's Big Ten championship game. My only concern about him would be on Memorial Day. I don't think he's in elite shape to play two games in 3 days. He was not himself against Hopkins. He looked fatigued, quite honestly. And then Christian Knight's playing great right now. He's 57% on the season. Was outstanding in the Ivy League championships that we covered, ESPNU from Columbia.
Well, I would call it the nightcap, but it starts at 2:30 from Annapolis, Maryland, Sunday. The Duke Blue Devils taking on the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays. This is the 4-5 matchup.
Yeah, and it's a matchup in recent history that has been dominated by Duke. We're talking blowouts. Last year's game in particular was you know, Hopkins was, as Coach Petromala said, physically tired, emotionally spent, and then had to deal with the distraction of Jerry Logan's academic suspension on game day. Got no goaltending. That game was over. This matchup will be closer. I guarantee it. Last two times the Jays have played Duke, it's been ugly. Duke was the better team in the two prior ones, and Duke's been getting the teens and the goals and all those. But I expect Hopkins to come out fighting. As Petro said, we're going to fight him in the parking lot. And that's the Hopkins you want to see. They've played their best games this year when they've been the attacking team. Whether it was the Big Ten championship, they attacked. They'll play free. I think they'll play hungry. I think this game is closer than most of the experts think.
In Duke's three losses, Justin Gutterding has gone for 3-3 and 2 points, and he's been guarded by some really good kind of All-American level players in those losses. Against Penn, it was Mark Ivancic. Against Notre Dame, it started out as Arden Cohen, and it turned into Hugh Krantz. And against Syracuse, it was Nick Mellon, who we have spent some time talking about. He's also, you know, he was relatively limited in their win over Loyola when Foster Huggins was guarding him. You know, really the only elite defense that he's exploded against so far this year is Denver. And my question for you, Quinn, is Patrick Foley at that level? And do you think he'll draw this matchup? And because the thing about, you know, we had this conversation about Connor Kelly in terms of who Hopkins was going to utilize against him. What's your expectation for their approach to Gutterding?
I would expect Foley to play Gutterding. I'm guessing that when Brad Smith starts on attack, that's a better fit for Owen Colwell, 16. Because Smith will run up top or from the wing, and I think that's just better for Colwell. The question is, what do you do with the poles? Do you get a pole? Do you cover Conley with a shorty? You know, can Daniel Jones handle that matchup? Or would you rather play standard down below? You know, put the pole on Robertson, who's the goal scorer. So there's options there. And the Jays, don't be surprised to see multiple personnel. And then I think, you know, Carolina's zone was semi-effective against Duke in the Carolina loss. I think it was a one-goal loss. So that's a way they can slow down a game that maybe goes off the rails. Face-offs are critical here. You know, Stein and Smith are very good for Duke late in the season. Their numbers have changed dramatically since the first 6 weeks of the season. Then you got Moreland and Prouty. Interesting, you know. I
have a hard time saying that there's going to be an advantage in that one if that's kind of where your hesitation is.
Duke's wings are very good, but Joel Tinney is also a very good player. Tinney's had a terrific season in my eyes, and I think he's the best all-around midfielder in the country that I've seen. At the other end, Duke's defense this year is one of the analytical question marks. Okay, when you look at their numbers, they've held the scrubby teams to nothing. Okay, 5 goals, 6 goals, 2 goals, 3 goals. When they've played quality opposition, they have been giving up double-digit goals. Okay, so their analytics are better than the product I see on the field. I asked John Danowski about that on Wednesday afternoon. He said they've had issues with their off-ball defense, but their on-ball defense with their shorties has been good. Well, if you're Johns Hopkins, you're not the most athletic team in the country. Okay, sorry, folks. Assault me on lax power for that one. That's just the facts, okay? Setting solid picks to change matchups could be the difference for Hopkins in this game. Because if they set really good down screens and make contact, Cole Williams can get some shifts, some switches. Duke has been willing to switch. They switch quite frequently if you watch the Villanova tape. So if Duke switches, then you can draw slides. Then you can beat them off ball. That's what Hopkins does best. They're a feet-set shooting team. Kyle Marr, feet-set. Brenton Vallis, dunks inside. Shaq Stanwyck, little stuff around the goal. Patrick Fraser, feet-set. Even Guido, when he had that good game the other day, feet-set. They're a feet-set team. They're a passing team. They don't want to shoot off the dodge.
It's great analysis. I love hearing it because I've been listening to a lot of NBA podcasts recently, and the conversation around switching in the Houston Rockets switch everything defense dominates. Defensive versatility is really in high supply, and we've talked about this with respect to, you know, Duke having two number one-esque long poles, or I'm sorry, close defensemen from an athletic standpoint, and that's an advantage that doesn't necessarily manifest itself against Hopkins. It'll be interesting to see how they choose to deploy Cade Van Rapphorst and JT Giles-Harris, particularly because I would argue, you know, I think Van Rapphorst is probably going to body up against Cole Williams, and that's not a surprise, but Giles-Harris, if you're trying to put him on the most dynamic athlete on the other end of the field, I want to see him cover Joel Tinney, and I think that would be an interesting kind of opportunity to see how they match feet. But beyond that, the goaltending for me is relatively equivalent. Brock Turnbaugh has played better than Danny Fowler, but I trust Danny Fowler from an experience standpoint, from an having been there standpoint, and so I kind of see that netting out as more or less a wash.
I think it's a wash. You know, Fowler at times tends to get a little jumpy. He's a little too kinetic for his own good. He's an athlete. He wants to show that. Sometimes he needs to do a little yoga pregame and just chill out and be a little more Dan Marsh-like. You can be your own worst enemy as a goalie. I'll make the analogy maybe on air. You know, you think about when you watch those wildlife shows. And my daughter likes wildlife, so she likes watching some of those shows, and we learn. But in the hunt, the hunter is always very still. Whether it's a snake going after a mouse, whether it's a lion going after an antelope, think about those hunts. They're defined by stillness. So that's what you have to be as a goalie. You want to be still, and then boom, you want to move. Hunt the shot, okay? Stillness to movement, okay? You can't be jumping around like to try to, if you're involved in the hunt. So you're still to move.
Quint, I think that's a great place to end. It is an excellent NCAA quarterfinal weekend.
Just getting started, Terry. Just getting started.
Then you got to save some of it for the broadcast. You got that yellow jacket. What's the wardrobe going to be like on Saturday?
Well, I have a yellow jacket, but it's not quite circa 1976 ABC Wild World of Sports Frank Gifford from Cornell final against Maryland, a game that was played at Brown University, 16-13 OT. That would have meaning. So I may swing by Goodwill later this afternoon. We can see what I can dig up.
Thanks, as always, for listening. If you like what you hear, leave a rating and review.
Go to these games, folks, really. Please. Watch them on TV, obviously, ESPNU. But if you have the opportunity, grab a friend, grab a coworker. These are going to be great lacrosse games. Grab some kids in your neighborhood who maybe are making the mistake of playing baseball and bring them to these games. And if you see me, Anish, or Clark, please say hi. But this is going to be fantastic. Long Island and Annapolis.
If you see me, I'm going to be at both.
I cannot wait.
Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.